Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in, and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice. After all, that has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of 1 Peter. We're now in chapter 2. We were last looking at verse 11. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts. And we were focusing on that particular phraseology, abstaining from fleshly lust, which he tells us, and we're about to talk about, wage war against the soul. Peter has been emphasizing our pedigree, to which we're to live up and not live down in this dark world. Understand who you are in Christ. Verse 9, you are a chosen race, using language that in the Old Testament was applied to Israel, to the new Israel, the church, the wider flock which is comprised of Jews and Gentiles alike. You are a chosen race. You're a royal priesthood, heirs and joint heirs of Jesus Christ, who also function as priest, whose business it is to bring gifts and sacrifices holy and acceptable to God. That's our life duty. We're a holy nation, a nation set apart by God, set apart for God, set apart from unrighteousness and impurity. And our business in this world, we explain again in verse 9, is that you and I may proclaim the excellencies of Him who called us out of darkness into His marvelous light. We are to be light and not darkness. We are to be salt in the earth, not saltless. Our business is not to pursue the American dream. Our business is not to pursue self-fulfillment. Our business is not to pursue happiness. Happiness will come to all those who know Christ and who walk after Christ. But the road to happiness is the highway of holiness. And that's the only thing that'll take us there. So let's understand that we were once not a people. We owe everything to God. But now we are the people of God. There was a time we had not received mercy, but then Christ came into our lives and we have received mercy. And it's exactly mercy that we have received because our relationship to Him is not based upon our performance, upon any merit or any pedigree that we may have had that commended us to God. So now, let's live up to who we are. Beloved, I urge you, as aliens and strangers here, to abstain from fleshly lust. The Greek word that is used there for lust can speak of desires generically, some of which are just human desires, like the desire for food and water, the desire to love and to be loved. There's nothing wrong with those. I desire shelter. There's nothing wrong with that. The desires that are out of line and out of bounds, and the desires that disgrace us and dishonor God, are those that we allow either to go to excess. They're legitimate desires. We want to love. We want to be loved too badly. We want to love either the wrong thing or a legitimate thing to excess. Whichever way it goes, we are told that those wage war against the soul. I want to talk about that phraseology so that we will grasp perhaps the seriousness of combating these fleshly lusts rather than just blowing them off. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Listen, in Mark chapter 4, verse 19, Jesus, in his parable about the various seeds, talks about the third kind of seed, and he says, "The worries of the world and the deceitfulness of riches and the desire for other things enter in and choke the word so that it becomes unfruitful," that is, in the sense that it yields no crop whatever. See verse 7 of Mark 4 on that point. It yields no crop whatever. Right there in that verse, we could see the seriousness of allowing fleshly lusts into our lives because they truly war against our soul. In James chapter 4, verses 1 through 4, James asks, "What is the source of the quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures, your desires that wage war in your members?" James goes on and he says, "You lust, you desire things, you don't have them. And so you commit murder, right up to and including murder. You talk about warring against the soul. These things get out of hand. And you're envious, and you do not obtain. So you fight and quarrel and dishonor God, and all of this is warring against your very soul. It's destructive. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive, because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it upon your pleasures," fleshly lusts, in other words. It's destructive, wars against the soul. Listen to this, he continues, "You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? It wars against the soul. You want to be a friend of the world. You want the world to like you. You want the world to admire you. You want the world to promote you. All of these are fleshly desires, and you pursue them. And at the end of the day, you find yourself an adulteress. Whoever wishes to be the friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. You love the world instead of God. You can't love both. No man can serve two masters." Listen to this in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 9. And I'm trying to get across, trying to explicate, if you please, what he means when he says, "I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lust." This stuff is serious, folks. For you, for me, for everybody, because these lusts, they're called fleshly lusts because we love legitimate things to excess, or we love illegitimate things, but the love of those things has a way of warring against our very soul and can actually destroy us. Listen to 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 9. "But those who want to get rich, they fall into temptation." There's a desire, a fleshly desire. They want to get rich. God makes some people rich. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong, as I've said, with the possession of wealth. But there's something wrong about wanting to get rich and to possess wealth. That's a fleshly lust. And when people do that, they fall into temptation, Paul says in 1 Timothy, and they fall into a snare and many foolish and harmful, that is, desires that war against the soul, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. That's how serious it can get. It just eats away the fibers, the connectivity between the soul of man and God. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. And Paul says some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith. Do you see how serious it can get? That's what Peter is talking about. These things war against the soul, and they pierce themselves with many a pang. Dear friends, listen to me. Don't just read phraseology like this and pass over it, as I said earlier with that, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts. Identify those things in your life where you desire certain things to excess. They're not illegitimate, but you desire them to excess. Or there are certain other things that you desire. We all have these tendencies because we're all still in the flesh. You desire, and they're illegitimate. Whichever one it is, identify them, because we are told they war against the soul. And when he says they war against the soul, he's saying they can destroy the soul. The more we feed the flesh, the more we starve the soul. The more we serve the flesh, the less we serve the spirit. These two principles, the flesh and the spirit, are inimical to one another. They are polar opposites. The flesh is a moral and spiritual undertow. It's a riptide in us that will carry our souls out to sea, separated from the fellowship and the service of God. In short, hear me, we cannot follow our fleshly cravings and follow Christ. Don't think you can put fleshly cravings on one shoulder and the cross of Christ on the other. We cannot, I said this earlier, serve our gut and serve God. We cannot be slaves of our drives and expect to be disciples of Jesus. That is why Paul spoke to the Roman procurator Festus in Acts chapter 24, verse 25, about righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come, because he was getting across to Festus that we cannot serve our God and serve God. We cannot be slaves of our drives and expect to be disciples of Christ. You have to choose. I have to choose between my cravings and Christ, between my drives that go with this flesh of mine and discipleship. There is no room for both of those in a Christian heart. Self-control lies at the core of surrender for Christ. This is not just pious froth up here in verse 11. Beloved, I urge you, as aliens and strangers, you're the people of God. You once weren't, but now you are. You're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. Look at your pedigree. Look who God has made you. You're in the world. You're not of it. You're aliens and strangers here. Don't live like you belong to the world. Abstain from fleshly lusts and see what the cost is. These things wage war against the soul, and we've all got them. But we need to be vigilant. We need to be on guard and doing everything we can to suppress them. Not just suppress them, but to substitute virtue for vice. Now in verse 12, he talks about the spiritual conflict without. This is a battle to be waged on two fronts. The first, we said, is inward. It's in us to abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. Now in verse 12, he talks about the external battle. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. Here he's talking about the heathen or the pagan, those who don't know God. Talking about people living in the Gentile world. Keep your behavior excellent. Live up to your pedigree among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, on account of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Let me talk about what we can expect from the world. The ancient Roman historian Tacitus reproached the first century Christians as those who were an object of hatred of the human race. Jesus said it, John chapter 15, if they hate me, don't be surprised that they hate you. And this great historian said, they're hated by everybody. Yet we've got these running around today telling us if we'd just live like Jesus, all the world would love us and embrace us. That's the purest nonsense. A famous church historian in volume 2 said this, then, too, the conscientious refusal of the Christians to pay divine honors to the emperor and his statue, their refusal to take part in any idolatrous ceremonies at public festivals. You know, you've got to have public unity, don't you, and what everybody calls for today. their aversion to the imperial military service, their disregard for politics, and the depreciation of all civil and temporal affairs as compared with spiritual and eternal interest of man, their close brotherly union and frequent meetings, drew upon the Christians he's talking about the suspicion of hostility to the Caesars and the Roman people, and the unpardonable crime drew upon them the suspicion, that is, of the unpardonable crime of conspiracy against the state. Hence, Christians were called enemies of Caesar and the Roman people. Elsewhere, he tells us in North Africa, the proverb arose, if God does not send rain, lay it on the Christians. At every inundation or drought or famine or pestilence, the fanatical populace cried out in those days, away with the atheists. They were atheists in Roman views because they didn't worship the Roman gods. To the lions with the Christians. Today, the bill of particulars against us Christians has changed. But what has not changed is the enmity of which Tacitus spoke. Of what vices do non-Christians not charge Christians with today? What slanders do they not smear our good names with? If we oppose as unnatural and perverse behaviors that both the Bible and the whole consensus of the human race from time immemorial has condemned until now, aren't we slurred today as intolerant, though these people have no compunction, it seems, about their own intolerance? We Christians are regularly accused of hate-mongering, racism, various forms of abuse. We are accused of shoving our views down the throats of the unwilling, though they constantly do it to us. We're accused of terrorism and intimidation. We're accused of warmongering, of divisiveness, of being insensitive, of lacking compassion, of being narrow-minded and indifferent to justice. Now, of course, Christians or professing Christians do sometimes relapse into their old fleshly reflexes, and individual Christians here and there can be justly accused of flagrant sins. However, by and large, these accusations are wildly unjust, are generally rooted in ignorance, represent nothing more than a classic reaction of psychological projection. That's where one attributes to enemies the vile behaviors and attitudes that they find most condemning in themselves. An eighth-grade sister thinks and fears she's being perceived as immature. What better way than to say to her annoying little brother, oh, you are so immature. So, we must keep our behavior excellent among the Gentiles. It's very important, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, and I've been showing you they always have and they always will, that they may on account of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God. So the world is going to pay us intense scrutiny. And Peter says, be careful to stay on the right side of the lines. Non-Christians take note of Christians. They're always watching. But here's what we can expect from God. There will be a confrontation with these in the day of visitation. That phrase, the day of visitation, is a bit ambiguous here in biblical usage. It can refer to any period of time in which God confronts or encounters an individual or group in some particularly intense way, visiting them with either grace or grief. The reference here may be deliberately ambiguous on Peter's part, for oftentimes it is in those situations when God visits unbelievers with enlightenment and grace that then they come to recognize and confess that their former slanders and vilifications of Christians were born of ignorance and driven by guilt and the desire for self-justification. But the phrase, the day of visitation, may also refer to the second coming of Christ. In that day, when all that is light and all that is produced of God, it will be revealed, and all that is of darkness and the devil will be exposed for what it is. In that case, it refers to the day of the Lord when unbelievers will in shame and terror then confess before God himself that what they despised, slandered, and condemned in the world were actually the works and fruits of the very Spirit of God himself. They will be forced to admit that they slandered good as evil and promoted evil as good. Probably both of those are referred to here. So there will be a day of vindication when the unbelievers glorify God. That happens in some cases when, in repentance, they turn to God and admit what they were up to before they knew God. And this will happen at the final tribunal also. When unbelievers face a holy God, they will be forced in shame and terror to acknowledge the righteousness of the righteous, whose good works, though wrought in God, they sullied, and whose motives they slandered and defamed. Isaiah said in chapter 26, verses 9, "See indeed, for when the earth experiences thy judgments, the day of God's visitation, the inhabitants of the world learn righteousness." Great Church Father Augustine said, "He who lives according to God ought to cherish toward evil men a perfect hatred, so that he shall neither hate the man because of his vice, nor love the vice because of the man, but hate the vice and love the man. For the vice being cursed, all that ought to be loved, and nothing that ought to be hated, will remain." The world is incapable of these distinctions of Augustine. It is able neither to hate its vices, nor to love the vicious. No wonder it cannot understand Christians, who by the grace of God are truly able to hate vice and to love the vicious in spite of their viciousness. But one day, God will expose the truth. And one day, in a time of visitation, whether that time of visitation is this side of the coming of Christ when God opens their eyes, or whether it's when Christ comes to judge, one day they will find the truth and they will see and confess that the righteous were righteous after all. So, beloved, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, among the pagans, among the unbelievers. This is our mandate. This is our obligation. The first thing we've got to concern ourselves about is on the inside, to abstain from fleshly lust. Very important, because they war against the soul. They corrupt us, and they are faith destroyers, and they can ruin us. So that at the end of the day, we prove to be hypocrites and not the real deal. But we must be light in the world. We must be witnesses of Christ, both in lip and in life. So keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. Live it up, not down. Live up to your pedigree. Remember who you are. You're a chosen race, a royal priesthood. We're a holy nation. We're a people for God's own possession. We exist that we may proclaim the excellencies of Him in lip and in life, the excellencies of Him who has called us out of darkness into His marvelous light. So let's live up to our pedigree so that in the thing in which they slander us as evildoers, which they will, they'll take everything that we do and twist it, defame it, and slander it. But if we stick with it, the day will come on account of your good deeds as they observe them. They will glorify God in the day of visitation, either having to confess when Christ comes that the righteous were right and righteous after all, or in the day when God visits some of them and their eyes are opened, their ears hear, and they become believers, they will acknowledge their error and how they defamed the righteous. One of our crying needs, folks, in the work of evangelism is more credibility. We can't take light to our neighbors that won't burn at home. We need to get with the program. And to get with the program means guarding against fleshly lusts that destroy the soul and keeping our behavior excellent, living up to the great name by which we are called. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.